Yeah. So let's dig a little deeper into that. You have an article called that you titled 10 Things Every Investor Should Know About Asset Classes. What are they? A lot of people are not even sure what an asset class really is.
Well, an asset class is simply a kind of a stock. Oh, by the way, it could be a bond as well. But the kind of a stock that many of them could have a similar kind of a company. They look alike in some way. For example, how about if we just looked at companies that were from $50 to $60 billion in value? How about if we looked at companies that were $2 billion to $3 billion in value? If you looked at all of them, you would find that they tend to kind of move together. In 1977, the S&P 500 was down 7%. But small cap value as a group, all of them that were called small cap value as a group, were up over 20%. And so what the academics are then able to do as they look at these different asset classes, big, small, value. By the way, value, those are companies that are out of favor. Growth, companies that are in favor. They tend to move as a group. And here's the thing that's so important. The academics believe and show, there's evidence for this, not just a belief, that nobody has the ability to say which of the small cap value companies or which of the large cap value companies are going to be the better ones 10 years from now and which are going to be the poorer performers. Because if somebody could do that, you could make unbelievable returns. You could make Warren Buffett look like a piker. Okay? So the bottom line is, what the academics say is, there's so much money to be made historically in simply owning these asset classes that there's no reason to try to pick the best ones, because you put yourself at greater risk and will likely make less rather than more. Now, if there are good asset classes, are there bad asset classes? And the answer is, historically, going back in some cases, literally hundreds of years, I guess. But yes, you know, the gold, for example, is an asset class that does not give a good risk-adjusted return. Now, might it be a good thing when our currencies are valueless and you have a pound of gold in order to buy a loaf of bread? Yes, that could be viewed as a good thing. But not as an investment, because the fact is, all the academic research is here for this, that over the long run, the return on gold is less than the return on long-term U.S. government bonds at about half the risk in the bond, two-thirds less risk in the bonds versus the high volatility of gold. So there are asset classes that are good historically, again, looking backwards, and there are asset classes that are not good looking backwards. But it's not enough just to know what a good asset class is. And there's a part on my website, one of the links on that bar is to performance. You need to know about two things regarding each one of these asset classes. What return have they achieved over the long run? That's always good for thinking positively. But let's think negatively for a second, because it's just as important. At what risk? What will I have to live through in order to get this possible long-term return? And if that risk is too great, then maybe you got to think twice whether you're going to have very much in that asset class. And here's the ringer, and the reason that I believe so in what the academics do versus Wall Street. I'm not a Wall Street fan at all. But the academics are the ones who taught us how to combine these asset classes in ways that it smooths the long-term return, takes some of the volatility out, some of the volatility that could hurt people. Let me give you one example. The S&P 500. From 1975 to 1999, it compounds at 17.2%. Somebody who started investing for their retirement in 1975 was they could retire in 1999 more than likely if they just let it ride. And when people were asked, how do you think the S&P 500 will do for the next decade? The average response was 20 to 30%. In different surveys, a year. But they had just gone through this 25-year period of 17% and a 5-year period of 28.5%. Comes reality. For the next 10 years, the S&P 500 actually lost money at a rate of about 1% a year. But if you had included the large and small, the value and growth, U.S. and international, and REITs, and emerging markets, little bits of pieces. I mean, you're not loading up on anything very much. That compound rate of return was over 7% a year. That's not a home run. But think about the people who might be using that money to live on and take out 4% a year. I'd call that a home run.
Hey, if I can hit a single... even 50% of the time that I'm at bat, I'm a happy guy, you know?
Yeah, and you know what? Here's a point about these asset classes. In fact, there's a piece called a table in there called the Four Fund Solution Table. It's under that performance headline, I think. But it shows the compounded 1-year return. Then I looked at 15 years. Because you really shouldn't be focused on 1 year, but the bad times happen in that 1 year, and you got to be ready for the worst of times. And I show you the worst of times. But then I go out to 15 years, and then I go out to 40 years, because we're not investing for the next year, those of us who are putting money aside for the long term, which even at almost 73, I'm putting money aside for the long term. We have to, particularly young people, got to look out a very long period of time. And guess what? The losing periods virtually disappear. There are no 40-year periods of losing money. There were 40-year periods you may have only made 8%, but there were other 40-year periods you made 16 and 18%.
So let's dive into that a little bit. You mentioned the four-fund solution. You, as I said before, are known for... your ultimate buy and hold portfolio. And the ultimate buy and hold portfolio is what's considered sliced and diced. It has a number of asset classes, each asset class holding a small portion of that portfolio. You're well respected, I think, in the Boglehead community. And for those of you who aren't familiar with that bizarre term, it's a forum online that is filled with tens of thousands of people who are all interested in their own personal finance and retirement investing. And they generally subscribe to Jack Bogle's theory of low cost, diversified, long-term index fund investing. And there are two camps in there. There are what are called the lumpers and then the slice and dicers. And the lumpers are the people who use generally three funds, maybe four funds, but they use a total U.S. stock market fund, a total international stock market fund, and a total U.S. bond market fund. And so they hold the whole market internationally, domestically. And generally, they'll hold less international than U.S., but nonetheless, each person chooses their own asset or their own allocations. And then the slice and dicers say, you know what? I'm going to own certain asset classes because I think those asset classes are going to perform better, and I think I'm going to be a little bit more particular about what I don't want to own. But generally, that means holding more funds. And then balancing requires a little bit more math and maybe a little bit more attention. So can you speak to this a little bit? Is a three fund portfolio better for some people, or can all average investors do a little bit better by being a little more sliced and diced? You know, what do you think? Can you walk us through these different portfolios, these different solutions?
Sure. In fact, allow me to even start at a more basic level. I think, in fact, in September, I'll be doing a presentation here on Bainbridge Island to people who work within the nonprofit industry, because, as you know, they don't make a lot of money, but they would still like to retire like everybody else someday. And what is the smart thing for them to do in terms of investing? I'll try my best to help them with saving. That's a difficult thing. But helping them with investing is in many ways dirt simple if they will agree with me about a certain ideas. But for most of those people who are not going to become experts, and I'll bet you have a lot of listeners that don't want to think that they have to be, as a do-it-yourselfer, are going to have to do a lot. Well, how about doing nothing? How about simply putting your money into a target date fund that is set up to be adjusted as you get closer and closer to your retirement? You simply put your money into the target date fund that says you're going to retire in 2060, and it manages your money kind of the old-fashioned Vanguard way, where they'll have some big U.S. and some big international, and then maybe even a little bit in bonds. But it will be very traditional John Bogle kind of portfolio.
Essentially, they have it's a fund made up of different index funds according the appropriate asset allocation for your age and when you would retire. Very straightforward.
Yes, and it's a great fund, but from my viewpoint, it has the same problem that I had with John Bogle for years, because he used to come on our radio show out here in Seattle once or twice a year, and we would always rib him a little bit because he just wanted to have money in the large cap funds. He didn't want any small cap or small cap value. He didn't even want any large cap value. He just wanted these very basic holdings. And he's right. It's a very kind of dependable, but you leave a lot of money on the table. But maybe that's okay if it allows you to stay the course. But here's what I want people to do that like target date funds. I would like you to extend yourself just a little bit. I'd like you to own two funds, and I would like you to have the target date fund, but I would like you to add maybe 10, maybe 25, maybe even for a very young person, 40% of the portfolio into small cap value. Why small cap value? Because those target date funds have almost no small cap in them and very little value. What do we know about small cap and value? They make more money over the last 90 years than large cap and growth. So could you do what it takes to have whoever you're buying your target date fund from put 10% or 25% or 40% in that small cap value fund and the rest in the target date fund? I think that is a life changer. Now, you're talking taking it one level higher than that. And that is to do it yourself, to put so much money in large cap U.S. The total market indexes is what they call them at Vanguard. So there's a total market for the U.S. and a total market for international. Nothing wrong with that, except you're likely to leave, notice the word likely to leave less to your children in charities and have less to spend in retirement than if you balance the portfolio to add some small cap and to add some value. Now, here's what I know historically. In my ultimate buy and hold strategy article, which is an all equity portfolio, then you can add as much fixed income to it as is appropriate. But in that all equity portfolio, from 1970 through 2015, by having your portfolio spread amongst 10 different asset classes instead of basically one or two, it adds about 1% a year. Now, I mentioned, and this is the all equity part of your portfolio, I mentioned earlier, Michael, about the half of 1%, what that could do for your life.
Mm-hmm.
For a 25-year-old putting away $5,000 a year for 40 years and then taking money out of that portfolio for 25 years. So you've invested $200,000. And what do you have between distributions and what's left for the family? About $2 million more if you make 8.5% than if you make 8%. A half of 1% could give you $2 million more to spend and to leave than the 8%. That's why I'm looking for an extra half a percent. And if I thought I could add an extra 1% to your portfolio and not expose you to more risk overall, I would say do it. But I still want to be sensitive to what you're comfortable with. I am not all that popular with the Bogleheads. I am oftentimes made fun of, partly because I do so much slicing and dicing, and secondly because I sound like a salesperson. I do, don't I, Michael?
Well, I don't know about that. And I would not, I don't think, I've never seen you in there get made fun of, that's for sure. And I have seen a lot of people support you and your work and are big fans. So just so you know that, in case you haven't seen that.
I appreciate that, but there, these differences that people have are serious differences. When people say, this is the way to do it, and then somebody else say, no, do this. If there are 1,000 different financial advisors, it doesn't surprise me when there are 1,000 different answers as to how you should do it.
Because, of course, we don't know anything about the future.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. We only know the past. So, you know, one of the things that I think people may have heard the word value and been like, well, what's the difference between value and growth? And wouldn't growth be better because it's growing? I don't get it. So most people, before I started studying this, I didn't understand the concept. And there's some differences in small cap, in the small cap companies compared to the large cap companies, and a number of different factors. I don't think we need to get into all of that, probably a little too wonkish. But could you just explain why value companies historically have produced better returns than other companies of the same size? Because they're the same size, but there's a value and there's a growth company. And what's the difference? And why is value typically expected to give a better return?
It's so simple. It really is simple. Let's say that you and I go in to borrow money from the bank. And we're sitting there with the banker, and they're asking us information about ourselves and what the money is for. And we looked over, and right there at the next desk is Bill Gates borrowing some money from the bank. that itself is kind of silly, but assume that he is. Who's going to pay the lower interest rates? The two of us with minimal assets behind us versus one of the richest people, maybe the richest person in the world. So, obviously, he pays less because he is less risky. Now, the banks also know that if they do a good job of asking us questions and if they secure the loan with a reasonable amount of collateral, that, one, they can get a higher return on us. Maybe instead of 4% interest, we pay 7% interest. They also know they take some risk. They're simply getting the premium for having taken this additional risk than loaning money to Bill Gates. So they become, if they could find all of us who are honorable and good business people, and we always pay back our loans, they become more profitable. But there is a risk. Now, we think of growth companies, popular companies, companies that are oftentimes selling at relatively high PE ratios, price to earnings ratios. People want those companies because they see they got a great future, and they pay up to get those companies.
Tech startups are a great example of those kind of companies.
Yeah, that's, by the way, that would be that would probably almost go into a separate group, because at this point, I'm talking about the well-known established growth companies,
what we would call
large growth companies that are worth billions and billions of dollars,
sure,
50, maybe $100 billion in value. Those startup tech companies, of course, they're very risky, as we know. But and where do you find these large growth companies in terms of large holdings in pension plans, and in 85% of the holdings of U.S. investors are in those kind of companies because they trust them. They're household names in many cases. Now, at the other end of the spectrum are companies that have a problem, and I don't know what it could be. Sometimes it could be something so simple as in 2000, back in the late 90s, Warren Buffett had a terrible time. There was a one-year period, his Berkshire Hathaway stock went down 50%, while the S&P 500 was going up. And that's because bricks and mortar companies, kind of companies that Buffett likes, they weren't doing well. It wasn't that they weren't making money, but the future was in technology. And whether it was startup technology or those that are established, that was where things were popping. They were hot. And so the out-of-favor companies tend to sell for a price that either is a low price-to-earnings ratio or, as the academics discovered, a better way to identify value companies is the relationship between their price and their book value. If you simply liquidated this company tomorrow, what could you get out of it? And those companies that have a low price compared to the book value, they go into this category of whether it's small companies that are value or large companies that are value, they are somehow companies that are out of favor. By the way, there's always a reason. It may only be psychological, or it may be financial, but there's a reason. It's not like this is a magic thing happening. What we know is, as a group, not one by one, the academics say don't even think about buying these companies one by one because they are risky, and you are likely to get a premium as a group. You might not get a premium for taking the risk of one company, but you buy 2,000 in my own portfolio. I think maybe I've got 6,000 or 7,000, and this is just through index funds, 6,000 or 7,000 value companies that are all out of favor for some reason. And historically, this is going to make sense, they make more money, because if they didn't make money, if the history of investors was that you invested in these out-of-favor companies and then you lost money most of the time, they'd say, hey, this doesn't make any sense. But just like small companies tend to make more money over time, so do out-of-favor companies make more money over time. And I'm not saying put all your money in those value companies, but I want some of my portfolio and the people who follow my work to be in those companies, never one by one, only in the form of an index where you get huge diversification, massive diversification.
And of course, that's the beauty. You don't have to do any analysis on any of these companies yourself. You don't need to be, you don't need to pay attention to the stock market every day. It's not what you do. You can buy an index fund, and that index fund, if it holds that asset class, you know you've got yourself covered. So what I hear you saying is, depending on the level of study you want to do and involvement you want to have in the in the management of your portfolio, you can either go with a total world fund. You could break it up a little bit more, but still lump together total U.S. stock market, total international stock market, total bond market. Or you can start to slice and dice a little bit more by adding in some asset allocations that historically, we don't know what they're going to do in the future, but historically have outperformed some other asset allocations. And that is going to require a better understanding of how the market has worked and currently works to feel comfortable, because if there's more volatility in this particular asset class. So if you're not comfortable with the choice that you're making, that's why you don't just see somebody else's portfolio and go, well, I guess I'll pick that. If you don't really know why you're making the choice for the long term, it's very likely that you're going to get out of that asset class as soon as that asset class runs against what the market is doing overall. So if your friends are all going up and your portfolio is going down because one asset class is going down, you might sell it, and then you've really hurt your chances of getting a good return over time. So it's important to consider how involved in this the individual wants to be. Is that correct?
That is correct. And you just, there are a whole bunch of things you said in there that I find of interest, but this whole idea of selling something that is out of favor, here's what a lot of the industry believes, and I've got a list of about 100 myths and realities that I'm putting together for the future, but one of these myths, I think, is that to be a successful investor, you sell your losers and you let your profits ride, your winners ride. Well, you see, if you picked 10 absolutely amazing asset classes from the past, okay, not we don't know the future again, but you picked 10 of them. In fact, you didn't have to be right on all 10 of them. If you were right on 9 of them, you're probably going to do just fine. But as they went up and down, if when one asset class was doing really well, you wouldn't hold it. You would sell off the excess profits to bring yourself back to your original asset allocation, and you take those excess profits and you would put it into those asset classes that have been struggling recently, believing they're going to stop struggling and then they're going to be better. Now, that becomes hard to believe when something has been doing poorly. So I understand why people want to get rid of their losers, but for many people, the losers are going to be the most profitable thing that happens to them, and I believe that 100% when it comes to young investors.
Now,
the very best thing that could happen to a young investor is to put that money away every month into their 401k and have the market go down the first 10 years. They're not investing in Enron or Eastern Airlines. They're investing in great companies that happen to be out of favor as a group when the market is down and dirty for a long period of time. But everything about the past says they come back. And when you can spend your early years buying bargains, it makes your retirement so much better.
And I imagine I don't hear you suggesting that you should try to time the market, but rather buy and sell in order to rebalance your portfolio to keep it in line with your stated objectives.
Yes, and that particularly becomes necessary between the equity portion of your portfolio and the fixed income portion. One of my favorite tools it's a table called fine-tuning your asset allocation. And it shows the combination of equity and fixed income in 10% increments. So you can look at the risk and return of an all-equity portfolio, 50% stocks and bonds, 20% versus 80% stocks and bonds. You can look at all these different combinations in 10% increments. You can see what the likely loss is along the way. Because I guarantee if you follow my advice, there'll be periods of loss. but how much is what you need to know. And that table is meant to help people make that decision when they see what the roller coaster is going to look and feel like. And until you write it, until it's more than just a story about the past, I promise it's a whole different event when you're on the roller coaster than when you watch it.
Now, I know people are going to want to know where they can find this fine-tuning your equity allocation table.
It's on paulmerriman.com, and where people can find my podcast, and it's under a link that says Best Advice. If people did nothing but read what's under the link that says Best Advice, they would have my best work in terms of decision making. Hmm.
So are you a proponent of dollar cost averaging?
Oh, I think it's amazing.
So
I literally think it is the path to success for the majority of investors. And I'll tell you why I believe that, Michael. Where do we see it that we can actually see it in action, that we can see that people are doing better because they're dollar cost averaging, putting in $100 every month and buying whatever $100 will buy? When the market's down, you buy more shares. When the market's up, you buy fewer shares. But what does it do for your long-term return? So I can go to Vanguard and I can look at one of their target date funds where everything is being taken care of for you. You don't have to rebalance anything. They do it. And I can look on Morningstar at the what they call the fund return, the share return, and the investor return. So the fund may have compounded, let's say, at 10%, but by tracking the money in and out of the fund, it might show that the real investors only got 7. And that is the case in almost every category of fund you look at, is that the investors aren't even coming close to the return of the fund and how the fund did. Because investors tend to buy when it's high. They tend not to buy when it's low, or they sell when it's low. The impact is you get lower long-term returns. But what gives me so much hope for individual investors who want to minimize their involvement, they put their money in target date funds, and the long-term studies are showing that the investors are getting virtually the same return as the fund or better.
How do you get better than the fund?
How do you do better? Well, you maintain this ongoing commitment to buying low, more shares when it's low and fewer shares when it's high. Remember, when they look at a fund return over 10 years, they assume there was a $10,000 investment on day one. And what's it worth at the end of 10 years? It ignores new money coming in or money coming out.
I see. Now that makes sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what's happening is that by being willing to do what is in your best interest, buying when it's low and buying less when it's high in terms of shares, that you come out ahead of a traditional buy and hold.
Do you prefer rebalancing via cash contributions or rebalancing by selling shares or buying shares?
Well, if you're adding money on a regular basis, or you know, even once a year, because I don't want you to rebalance more than once a year, you can actually use any new contributions to do the rebalancing. Now, that's a complex subject because, in a sense, let's say you're adding money on a monthly basis, it suggests that you're rebalancing once a month. And we know that if you don't rebalance too often, you tend to make a better return than if you rebalance often. And it's very easy to understand in that if you have more money, let's say you had a portfolio of 50-50 stocks and bonds, and so you started the year and the stock funds just went straight up all year, the bond funds did very little. They kind of went sideways all year. Well, if you rebalance every month, you're going to be taking money out of equities, some money out of equities, and put it into bonds every month, every month. So what happens is, at the end of the year, because you were punishing the part of the portfolio that was most productive, you end up making less money than if you simply let it ride. Hmm. So it's not magic. By the way, by getting that higher return, you also took more risk because you had more equity in the portfolio.
So the rule of thumb is often, you know, rebalance once a year. Sometimes they say every 6 months, but once a year. But what's your trigger? Do you have, say, some people have a 5% trigger. If in 3 months the portfolio goes out of whack by at least 5%, then you'd rebalance then rather than waiting till the end of the year. Do you have a trigger? Do you have a recommendation?
I do not. I can tell you that in any period, whether it be the last 10 years or the last 25, you can fine-tune that process based on the results of that 10 or 25-year period and produce a better return if you use those kind of triggers. But the chance of it being the same the next 10 or 25 years is not nearly as good as you think it would be, because, well, it worked for the last 25. Why is it not being that productive this? Because the market will always be different in some way. The reason I don't encourage people to do it more often, one is it requires you to do work that you may or may not get a return for, probably not. The other thing is equity asset classes tend to go on a tear, and they go that for much longer than a month or two or 6 months. And so if you sell the good ones too soon, you leave a lot of money on the table. Also, it's good when the bad stuff keeps doing worse, which also tends to happen. And so if you wait a while, you tend to sell more profits from the good stuff and buy in at lower prices on that part that's been struggling.
It seems that some of the studies on momentum would support that, and that the companies that are doing well for 12 months will often have another 12-month ride, and then the companies that are doing poorly will, for 12 months, will have another 12-month loss. So I get that. Of course, this is just a generalization based on some studies that aren't really, I think, relevant for the conversation. But I think that makes sense to me. I get that. Puts it in perspective.
Good.
Can you, sometimes people use compound rate of return, and sometimes they say they use annual rate of return. What's the difference, and what should the average investor be concerned with?
Well, I think what I'd like to do is differentiate between the compound rate of return, because it could be the compounded annualized return. It's a question, is it compound or is it average? And the difference is huge. I mean, I go back to that half of 1%. If you're making your plans based on average rates of return, I can tell you the S&P 500 has an average rate of return of 12% over the last almost 90 years. Its compound rate of return is 10, and that's the one that you should think in terms of for the long term. But let me give you an example of why there's a huge difference. Let's say that year one, you put in $100 and the market goes up 50%. So your $100 is worth $150. Now let's say the market goes down 50%. Your $150 becomes $75. The average rate of return, plus 50, minus 50, is zero return. The compound rate of return is over a 12% a year loss. Are you with me on that one?
Yeah.
I mean, it's misleading. And what bugs me so much is that there are people on the radio who will talk about the average return of the S&P 500 is 12%. Well, I can almost guarantee you they're selling something. They're selling something, because nobody in this business is expecting from the S&P 500 for the long term a 12% compound rate of return, which is what you'll have to spend, not the average rate of return.
The financial author Michael Bernstein said the reason that the word guru is so popular is because the word charlatan is so hard to spell.
Yes, I am not a fan of gurus because they hurt people.
Yeah.
They hurt people because they have ways to appear to be trustworthy, and we confuse a past record. Well, I'm a Jim Cramer. Now, I happen to have spoken with Jim Cramer. I have a home down in San Miguel de Allende, and he has a couple homes down in San Miguel de Allende. Last I heard, he did. And I like him. I enjoy him. And he comes across as a very humble guy as an individual off of the set. But what he does on the set is, I think, encourage people to believe that there's something more than is there. Mark Hulbert, who unfortunately his newsletter has been terminated or disbanded, whatever the word is, but he followed Jim Cramer up until the end of 2015, and I've followed Cramer's results, and it's about half of that of the S&P 500.
Yeah. Alan Roth, I'm sure you're familiar.
I know Alan.
Yeah, so he did an article where he broke down almost all of the TV personalities and their results over time, and it's astonishing.
Yeah.
It's the old monkeys throwing the darts would do a better job.
Yes, and there's a reason for that, by the way. Those darts are going to land on a certain number of small cap value companies. It is interesting all the ways that we mystify this business, and that's why I focus on what University Street has taught us as opposed to Wall Street. I don't have one sense of trust in Wall Street. I know lots of people who work in the industry. I like them. They're nice people. But as an industry, I would not ever want to suggest that that would be the basis of one's plan for guidance for a lifetime. Hmm.
Last question, and it's a big one. Big one. You wrote a wonderful article, and you then did a blog post as a follow-up to it because some folks were not so pleased with the title of the article. They thought it was a little too hyperbolic, but I thought it was a great title because it got people to pay attention, and it was, in fact, accurate. So your article was about how to turn $3,000 into $50 million. It's very provocative. So tell us how we can do this.
It's so simple. I mean, this is what I love about this strategy. Now, I can guarantee this. At age 73, I am not going to turn $3,000 into $50 million. But I know how to do it for a newborn child. And that's what that article was about. And it does not have to be $3,000 once. It could be $365 a year for 21 years. Here it is, step by step. It's so easy. You put away the $3,000 or the $365 a year into an asset class. It could be an ETF, and I even name on my website the ETFs you could put it into, at Vanguard or Fidelity or TD Ameritrade or Schwab. And you keep putting that money away for that newborn child until they start putting money aside for retirement. That's when they start earning any money. They're 15, they earn some money. Legitimately, you can then, in essence, put that into a Roth IRA for that child. But you do that until this money you set aside, either the $3,000 or the $365 a year, you do that until the money's gone. And it's all in a Roth IRA now. Now you leave it alone. You leave it alone. You don't do anything until the child is 65. At that point, they start taking out 4% a year. And I assume in the article that they live to be 95. Now, from that measly $365 a year, it grows to about a $20 million distribution during your retirement and a $30 million inheritance for children and charities. Now, there's so much that can go wrong. The first thing that can go wrong is that instead of making 12% in small cap value, way down from its historical 16%, by the way, instead of getting 12, you get 10. Here's the good news. The long-term return of 10 is not all that bad either. And I've got tables in that article that you can link to that show the returns of 4, 5, 6, all the way up to 12% a year. So you can see over a lifetime what it would mean. The other struggle is keeping this kid's fingers off of that money. Now, not everybody understands the reward for delayed gratification. So one of the things I do in another short article that goes along with the basic article is share a letter to a grandchild so that as a grandparent, I may not be around in 21 years. And so I want somebody to be able to hand that letter to that grandchild that talks about what this money is about. Because we're going to war here. As a grandparent, I know what I want my grandchild to do. But I know Wall Street has other uses for that money. The spouse of my grandchild may have other uses for that money. The grandchild may develop habits that lead to other uses for that money. This is not a slam dunk in terms of having it be what we want it to be, but we have done the things which should include an education to make it happen. Mm. And it will happen to some families. It will change generations to come, because you do this right once and it's going to be done more than once for others in the family.
Beautiful. And here's, I'm sure you know this, many of my listeners may not, but if they own businesses and they have, and they're C-Corp or an S-Corp, and they can pay a salary to a child. Now, the child has to be reasonably old enough to do some kind of work that is legitimate in the business. You know, my 11-year-old and 12-year-old can work in the business. They'll sell at events, they'll sell t-shirts, they'll file papers for us, they'll do online research. It's a whole bunch of things that they do. And they get paid $6,300 a year for their work. And of course, it's a business expense. So it is tax deductible for me. And because they have such little income, they are not paying any federal taxes. And because they have earned income, they are allowed to invest in a Roth IRA. Mm-hmm. So that money is not taxed at the beginning. It's not taxed in the middle, and it's not taxed at the end.
Yeah.
And $6,300 goes into this fund every year for them. Each month they get their paychecks, which automatically go right into the Roth. And if they pick this up when, as you said, they start to work, they'll produce a significant retirement account pretty early on, and will have some assets if, as you said, they don't muck it up.
Yeah. And one of the things, I'm not a tax expert, I did when I had my first grandchild many, many decades ago, I had a mail order company that I owned, and we hired him to be a model, and
yes,
he actually
yes.
made the front page.
Yeah.
Of the and at that time it was $2,000 yeah. that we could.
So if the child is younger and adorable, as most children are.
They
can't, you know, they can't do their filing. You can't do, or they can't sell things for you, but they can be a model, and that's legitimate, work for them.
That's right.
It's fantastic. I love it. And, teaching the delayed gratification is a big deal. I'm not a person who has, a natural ability to delay gratification. I have to work against my natural instincts. Like, I'm great at spending money. I've got a gift for it. No, really, I'm very good at it.
What about your wife?
She's better than I am. She's definitely better than I am.
Most couples, yeah.
But the thing is that, you know, we got to the point in our life where we saw what we wanted our future to be. And because of that significant connection that we have to the future, we do now what needs to be done to get us where we want to go. And we know what that number is, and we know how much we need to put away each year, and we're doing the work. But with the kids, we have an allowance system set up for them. I read a book called The Opposite of Spoiled. Very good book. The Opposite of Spoiled. And the author outlined an allowance structure that we adopted, and it's worked very well, to teach them delayed gratification and how money makes money. So they get an allowance each week. They get an amount equal to their age. So the 11-year-old gets 11 and et cetera. And, and then 10% goes into their giving jar.
Good.
50% goes into their savings jar. 40% goes into their spending jar. However, if they take anything that they, instead of putting into their spending jar, they put into their savings jar, they get a 50% bonus.
I like that.
So if they put their $4 into their savings, they get an extra two. Now, they can only spend their savings every 6 months. However, there are bonuses for saving too. So you are de-incentivized to spend it.
Oh, I like that.
And so both of the boys saved for an entire year. Now, here's the thing. It's all the other things that they want, anything they need, we buy. But if they want an app for their phone or something that is really disposable, they have to buy it. That's what they're getting allowance for. And the allowance is not tied to chores. Chores are chores. You do chores, you don't get paid for chores.
Yeah.
So what happens is they don't buy apps like they used to. They don't buy the things that aren't really important. And they saved each one for a year. And one of them purchased a computer and the other one purchased parts to build a computer. And now they're saving again. They're starting over.
That's great.
Isn't that cool?
That is, what's the name of that book again?
The Opposite of Spoiled.
Well, I will read that for sure, and I hope a lot of your listeners do, because these are amazing lessons to be able to teach young people. The idea of delayed gratification, we know from the studies that those people who learn delayed gratification by the time they're 13 or 14 years old are the ones who go on to do better in school. They tend to be more socially adjusted. They do better in their work life. And they're obviously going to probably have a better retirement financially than the people who do not delay gratification. What a bonus to help your children get there. Congratulations.
Well, I don't know. Don't give me a pat on the back yet. We got a couple more years to go before they're out on their own. Hopefully we won't screw them up in the next couple of years. But two books all of our listeners should read. Certainly, we just mentioned that Opposite of Spoiled. But that's for their kids. For them, they need to read Financial Fitness Forever. And that is, of course,
may I also suggest free books? I have three. One is First Time Investor, Grow and Protect Your Money. One is 101 Investment Decisions, Guaranteed to Change Your Financial Future. And the third one is Get Smart or Get Screwed, How to Get the Best, How to Select the Best and Get the Most Out of Your Financial Advisor.
Oh, that's great. That's fantastic.
I hope their life changes. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, don't go yet. I just want to say I want to say one more thing. So he said those books are free. Usually when somebody is giving away something for free, there's an opt-in and then they will start selling you other products. That's not the case on Paul's site. He is doing this for you, and you're not going to start getting marketing emails from Paul trying to get you to go to seminars or something like that.
Well, if there's a seminar, it's free.
Yeah, or it's exactly, exactly. So, listen Paul,
all the best.
Thank you so much. This is really an honor to have you here. I truly appreciate it. You're a very good man for the work you're doing, and I've learned so much from you.
Great. Good luck to you and your listeners. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. And now a final thanks to our sponsor. So remember, keep thinking big about who you are and what you offer the world. I love you very much, and not in a weird way, but I do. I love you for being the big thinker that you are, for standing in the service of others as you stand in the service of your destiny, and for committing to playing the biggest role that you can in your life. Bye for now.